Good morning, everyone. We're just about to start. Thank you. Thank you and welcome to today's session on How Women Rise, where you're going to hear from two world-renowned authors and career coaches on some of the habits that we as women need to become aware of and change if we actually want to rise within our organizations. I'm Rakhi Kumar, your MC for this session, and I'm delighted to be here to learn from two of the best in the field. I'm a senior manager at State Street, the firm that is responsible for the fearless girl, that girl down in Wall Street that is challenging companies to add more women in the workplace. And we are proud to be partners of the Massachusetts Conference for Women. We have an amazing hour in store for you, and I know that because I actually read the book. So if you haven't done already, please go ahead and read this book. It's already helped me. I've identified many habits that I have that I need to change. So we're honored today to have with us Sally Helgeson, who was the first leadership coach to focus on women and women's contributions in the organizations. She has been working in the field for over 30 years and is now one of the leading experts on women's leadership. Sally has been ranked among the top 50 leadership authorities by the Leadership Excellence magazine and has worked with the United Nations to build more inclusive offices in Africa and Asia. And joining Sally is Marshall Goldsmith, the number one leadership thinker and executive coach in the world. For over 40 years, Marshall has been working to successfully help leaders achieve positive, lasting change in behaviors for themselves, their people, and their teams. He has authored or edited over 40 books and has three New York Times bestsellers, including Triggers, Mojo, and What Got You Here Won't Get You There, to his name. Please welcome, please join me in welcoming Sally and Marshall.
Looks like we have a good turnout, Marshall. Thank you. It is a joy and a pleasure to be here in this magnificent city of Boston and to address the Massachusetts Conference for Women, to have an opportunity to share our joy and excitement around the book we co-wrote, How Women Rise, which is about the behaviors most likely to get in the way of successful women as they seek to move higher. For 30 years, I have been on a remarkable journey working with women leaders and aspiring women leaders all around the world to help them to recognize, articulate, and act on their greatest strengths. But I've written 8 books in the field, but I consider How Women Rise to really be the culmination of the work I've done over the last 30 years. Marshall and I partnered on How Women Rise. Marshall had written a brilliant book, international bestseller, called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And it had an extraordinary template. Marshall's idea was that the same behaviors that can serve you well early in your career can become a problem as you move to higher levels. The book is terrific. I used it in many of the workshops I did all over the world. But I was also aware, as I read that book, that while the template was perfect, there were certain behaviors that weren't necessarily much of a problem for women, and other behaviors that I'd noticed that were problematic for women that were not in the book. So I suggested to Marshall that we collaborate. One of the behaviors he had was learn to apologize. So as most of us know, there are many women who cannot open a door without saying, I'm sorry, or enter a room. So that's not that big a problem for many of us. And another was stop talking all the time about how great you are. Again, not much of a problem for many women. So Marshall and I decided to collaborate on this book, which took that template and adapted it to women. So we're going to be talking about 3 of the behaviors fairly briefly because we want to leave plenty of time for question and answer. But I'll now ask Marshall to say a few words about the experience of the book.
Well, my name is Marshall. I'm from Kentucky, went to school in Indiana, got a PhD at UCLA, and I do three things. I travel around, I give talks or teach classes. I've been to 102 countries, have 11 million frequent flyer miles just on American Airlines. Have any of you seen the movie before called Up in the Air with George Clooney?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the card. And now that we're in a women's program, this always happens to me with the card, especially with women. I show them the card. They always say the same thing. You look just like George Clooney.
Oh, yeah. Tell it to Amal. She's here.
So the first thing I do is speaking and teaching. And what I'm most famous for, I coach executives. So I've been the coach of many, many CEOs, Ford, Pfizer, Glaxo, World Bank, Mayo Clinic, on and on. And that's what I love to do, and I learn so much. And then I write and edit books and articles. And Sally and I have known each other, what, 25 years?
25 years.
We've been friends for 25 years, so we're old buddies. And Sally gave me the idea for the book, which has been fantastic. And just one comment. I asked Sally this. I said, in my work with women and men, I've noticed a couple of differences. One, the average woman gets better 360-degree feedback than the average man.
Yeah.
It's not a theory. It's a fact. The average woman does get better 360 feedback than the average man. The average woman, as Sally's already alluded to, has one issue far more than the average man. Women are harder on themselves than men.
Yeah.
Much more self-critical. So one coaching I have with women much more than men is, please don't be too hard on yourself.
Yeah.
You can't be the perfect everything to everybody. Can't be the perfect wife, mother, friend, boss, everything in the world. Don't be too hard on yourself. And what I tell men when I work with men is, I say, men, for us, there's bad news, but good news. Bad news for us men is we're not as good. Good news is we don't care.
So true. Yeah, so true. So...
This... Some of the women in the room, the light bulb finally went off, right? Exactly. It's all making sense now.
Exactly. So this book is written for women who really care and who may give themselves too hard a time. So again, we're going to focus on three behaviors. I'm going to start with one, and it's one of my favorites, and that is behavior number two in the book, which is expecting others to spontaneously notice and value what you contribute rather than having to bring attention to it yourself. I have been aware of this behavior for many decades. I was commissioned some years ago to do a study of women who were in partnership firms, law, investment banking, consulting, accounting, and interviewed a lot of women partners. One of the questions I asked is, what are the women who have the potential to be partner, what are they best at, and what is their biggest challenge? And the answers were remarkably consistent. They're best at doing A-plus work, high-quality work. They're conscientious. They show up. They go the extra mile. They care. What they're worst at is bringing attention to the quality of the work that they do, especially among senior leaders. And when I ask women, when I survey women and say, are you good at drawing attention? When they say, no, I'm not, and many of them do, it's very common, I hear that response a lot, and I'll say, why not? What holds you back from representing what your achievements are? And I often hear one of two comments. The first is, you know, if I have to act like that jerk down the hall to get noticed around here, no thank you. The second one I hear is, I believe that if I do good quality work, people should notice. And maybe they should, and they probably should. In an ideal world, they would. But that's not the world we live in. And we live in a world that's very, very busy. And every one of us needs to find a comfortable way of bringing attention to what we're best at. Because the consequences of expecting that someone else is going to notice, especially our boss, can be ruinous. You can end up feeling really disengaged. In the book, we profile a woman out in Silicon Valley who was an engineer, and she said, you know, I had an extraordinary experience when I got my performance review. She said, one of the things I believe that I'm best at is connecting people. I know a lot of people. I'm more extroverted than a lot of the other engineers in my group. She said, but when I went away for my performance review, my boss said, Your work is excellent quality, but you need to be more connected. Mm-hmm. And she said, I left that performance review thinking, feeling, I don't belong here. I've got to find another boss. Maybe I need to find another company. I'm just not valued for what I contribute. She said, I spent about 3 weeks feeling really bad. And then she realized that, in fact, her boss had no way of knowing that she was a good connector because she had never told him. He didn't monitor her emails. He didn't watch her office door. So she devised a kind of ritual where every Friday morning she sent him a two-line, no longer email, Dear Jim, this week I connected with X, Y, and Z. That was it. And she said after about a month she began to feel like an absolute fool. She had no feedback from it. She ran into him at something a month after that. They were not co-located, and he came up to her and he said, I want to tell you how valuable those emails you've been sending to me are. He said, because it helps me understand all the people that our unit is connected with. It is information I need to know. So one of the things I often tell women who are reluctant to talk about what they do is find a way to frame it as information. Think of it as information that is valuable for other people to know, and that will get you out of that either-or mindset that you're either like the obnoxious jerk down the hall who you don't want to be like, who's sucking up the air and constantly talking about how great he is, or you just hang back and expect others to notice. So that's that behavior, expecting others to spontaneously notice and value your contributions. It won't get you where you need to go. So Marshall, you have a behavior you really enjoy talking about, which is putting your job before your career.
And before I get into that one, again, back to Sally's point, this idea of my good work should speak for itself. God doesn't give a crap about your good work. He's not going to fly out of the sky and say, oh my goodness, she did good work and recognize it. If that were true, no company would need a marketing function.
Yeah. That's right.
If that were true, no company would need a marketing function. They just make great products and they would speak for themselves and then everything would be fine. Well, you are your marketing function. And Sally and I agree, when many women we work with, their work is fantastic.
Yeah.
Their marketing is abysmal.
Yeah.
And so really, you are in charge of your own marketing to a degree. And I think it's really healthy. If you do a great job, don't be ashamed. If you do a great job, don't be ashamed to promote yourself, because the guy down the corner is not ashamed. They're promoting themselves. So don't be ashamed to promote yourself.
Yeah.
Now, the next behavior that Sally taught me, mm-hmm. this was a breakthrough for me in the book. I had never thought of this concept before, and that is putting your job before your career. Many people sacrifice their career for their job. And I never thought of that concept, and it's kind of counterintuitive. Our instinct is, if I do a good job, I should be rewarded. Well, if you think about it, that doesn't even make sense on the surface. If you do a good job at this level, it doesn't necessarily mean you're the most qualified to be promoted at the next level, number one. And number two, women can become fixated on doing this perfect job at the expense of their career.
Yeah.
So what means is you're doing about a 95% quality as it is. Rather than saying, that's fantastic, I'm going to devote this extra energy into meeting people, to learning something new, to preparing for the next job, it's trying to turn that 95 to a 99.
Yeah.
And I had this feedback myself, too.
Yeah.
And I can relate to this because I got feedback myself. I did a program for the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm. and a friend of both of ours, Rick Culley, I got it rated 4.8 out of 5. And I called him in, and I said, Rick, how can I do better? And he said, you're asking the wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
You're already ranked 4.8 out of 5. Some people don't give 5s. It's probably not going to get much better. You ought to be asking, how can I write things? How can I think bigger? How can I have a bigger career? How can I make a bigger contribution? Not how can I turn this 4.8 into a 4.9. You're missing the boat. You're majoring in minors.
Yeah.
And it was such good feedback for me. And then when Sally started writing about it in the book, I see this more often with women, and it's that desire to do this perfect job,
right.
As if somehow if I do this perfect job, then it's going to be God is going to come down again and recognize me, and I'm going to get promoted. And sometimes that's really dysfunctional. Let me talk about a couple of ways.
Sure.
One is falling in love with your job. Women are much more likely to do that than men. Fall in love with your work team. I've never heard a man say this. A woman gets an opportunity to leave. Well, I can't leave my team. Yeah. They'll be disappointed. A man, I love my team. I love my team. They're fantastic. The next week, here's 10% more. Goodbye, team. Well, sometimes women get so focused on, I must do a good job for this team, which is a good thing, but you're maybe not making the biggest contribution you can make in your life. Because when you get promoted, then you can make more of a difference to a bigger team, bigger places, move bigger things, make bigger impact. That's one area.
Yeah.
And the other area is even worse, is that, how many of you ever had this happen? Your boss gives you a job, and then you do a fantastic job. In recognition, what do you get?
More.
More. You do a great job. What do you get? More. You do a good job. What do you get? More. Oh, and then you can't get promoted. You know what? You have become indispensable. Indispensable. Everyone look up here. Does that sound familiar to anyone in the room? Yeah, then you become indispensable. Well, I can't promote her. She's now indispensable.
Yeah.
Well, you've just killed your own career. And so I think very important to think about what is this balance between, I do want to do a great job. On the other hand, I don't want to sacrifice my career for my job. And sometimes that 95% of your job is just fine. Just fine. And put that extra 5% on your future, your career, your life, looking ahead, the big things.
You know, Marshall, I think there's something else, that kind of loyalty trap where I often hear women say, I just love my team. I don't want to leave my team. I did a program for a huge international banking institution, and it was really fascinating, gives some pushback on the utility of that way of thinking. What they found is that this company had a very robust promotion of women program, and when they did a big international survey, they found that actually both women and men reported that they would prefer to have male bosses. So I was working with them, and I said, let's really drill down and find out the reason. You know what the reason was? People felt that if they had a male boss, that male boss was more likely to get promoted and it would be good for their careers. So the best thing you can do for your team is get promoted. That's how your team will see it. The more successful, the more powerful you become, the more influence and authority you have in the organization, that's going to benefit your team as much as you're staying with the team and helping to help that team really work beautifully together. So that was a big learning point for me. So as women, you know, we tend to be, I mean, research shows women are more loyal and place a higher value on loyalty to their organizations. This is a good thing, and it can help us make some very good decisions. But it can also keep us stuck. And when we get stuck like that, we tend to feel bad. I mean, it's one of the things we found in the book is that, you know, when men get stuck or feel like the behaviors are getting in the way, they get angry. When we get stuck, when we feel like our behaviors are getting in the way, we think, oh, maybe I don't belong here. I feel bad. I'm not appreciated. And that's not a good way to feel. Not going to help us move higher.
Good. What's number three?
The number three, the behavior I'd love to just touch on, and it's a complicated one, is building rather than leveraging relationships. And this is really something that I've learned a lot about from Marshall. It had always puzzled me, you know, going back to my first book in women's leadership field, The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, which I'm very proud to say was the first book published in 1990 that focused on what women had to contribute rather than how they needed to change and adapt. And one of the... Thank you. That was a big deal. Thank you. And one of the things that I learned doing that book is how superb women are at building relationships. And that's one of the real great skills and advantages that women often bring to organizations, building strong relationships and building relationships where building organizations where good relationships can flourish. Part of what we're talking about with team loyalty. So it had always surprised me as relationship building has become more and more recognized as a chief desirable mainstream leadership capability. Why didn't women benefit more from that? But from working with women, what I became aware of is that while women are great at building relationships, they're often not as good at leveraging relationships. That is, engaging other people as allies to help them achieve goals that can be either tactical, specifically related to their job, or strategic, related to their career. So we often are reluctant to make that ask of people. When I ask women who are reluctant to do that, why are you reluctant? I hear, I don't want to be perceived of as a user. I want people to know that I really value them for themselves. But one of the most valuable things you can do for the people you care about is to get into a position where you have some real authority and influence and are able to use your talents in the best way. So we've got a lot of examples in the book, How Women Rise, for different ways of leveraging relationships that can be comfortable for women, so that you're not just stuck building them and feeling as if it's not getting you anywhere. How to make those asks of people to get them engaged in your development, in achieving specific objectives. Really important.
You know, since we wrote the book, I've been more aware of this. And there's something called the Franklin Effect, named after Benjamin Franklin. And what he's learned is when you ask people to do something nice for you,
yes,
it's counterintuitive, but you actually build a positive relationship.
That's correct.
They feel kind of complimented and honored, not insulted. And it's called the Franklin Effect, named after Benjamin Franklin.
So
but
interesting.
It's exactly the same as what you said. Women are much more likely to do the favor.
Right.
But
yes,
less likely to say, you know, I did a favor for you. Would you mind doing a favor for me?
Yeah.
To ask for that order back. And sometimes we feel, like you said, manipulative. But if you look at the Franklin Effect, it was very fascinating. Stephen Berglass wrote a book about this.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at it, people do feel honored. If you looked at some young woman that came to you and said, look, I want to have a great career. I would really appreciate your advice. Could you help me? How would you feel?
You feel good.
You feel good. You wouldn't feel insulted. You feel positive. So anyway,
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I was just reading some new research that had come out that the primary reason people do favors for other people is that it makes them feel good about themselves. So what I say to women is, if you're reluctant to do that, why would you deprive other people of a chance to feel good about themselves? That's what you're doing.
That's right.
Yeah. So we want to leave plenty of time for questions, but I want to just one moment, because Marshall has something he does very well. I think one of the reasons that How Women Rise has become as successful and influential as it has been, and the experience has really been extraordinary, is that we don't just diagnose behaviors. We also present a template for change. And the template has four parts. The first is start with one behavior. I have women come up to me and say, I have 9 of the 12 behaviors. I don't know where to start. Start with one thing or one part of one thing. Start with whatever is easiest. Start there. And then begin soliciting help. Ask people. I'm trying to get better at being more concise in my presentations. Could you watch me? I notice you're very concise in your presentations. Do you have any tips for me? Anything you do in preparation? You're advertising the fact you're changing. You're engaging allies in your own development, which is very powerful. And this is Marshall's research shows, done with, I think, over 800,000 people, that the people who get better, the people who make positive behavioral improvements over the course of their adult life, are people who engage others and ask others for help in doing that. So we have lots of exercises in the book, but one of Marshall's real innovations is a daily question. So I'm going to let him tell you a bit about that, and then we'll move on to our questions.
Okay, everybody needs one or two partners. To Mark's cassette, find a partner. Go. One or two. Okay, stop. Shh, shh, shh. Shake hands with your partner. Say, partner, my name is, I'm here to help. Go, go, go.
Love it.
Now, I'm now going to teach you something. I'm now going to teach you something that takes 3 minutes a day, costs absolutely nothing, is going to help you get better at almost anything. Some of you are skeptical now. 3 minutes a day cost nothing. Help me get better at almost anything. That sounds too good to be true. Half the people that start doing this quit within 2 weeks. And they do not quit because it does not work. They quit because it does work. I have a woman call me on the phone every day to make sure I do this. Why? My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I got ranked number one executive coach in the whole world. I have a woman call me on the phone every day to make sure I do this. Why? I'm too cowardly to do this by myself. I'm too undisciplined to do this by myself. I need help. And it's okay. We all need help. We all need help, and it's okay. One thing I'm really proud of in my book, Triggers, 27 major CEOs endorsed the book. Why am I so proud of that? 30 years ago, no CEO would admit to having a coach.
Yeah.
They would have been ashamed. Well, today, these very important people say, you know, I won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I need help. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm CEO of the year. I need help. It's okay. Now, who we can, we all need help. It's okay. Now, this process is called the daily question process. Are you ready? Look into the eyes of your partner. Look into the eyes of your partner. I want you to imagine your partner is going to call you on the phone every day for the rest of your life. Every day for the rest of your life. That partner is going to call you on the phone. Now, again, here's your homework assignment. You're going to get out a spreadsheet. On one column, you're going to write down a series of questions that represent what's most important in your life. Friends, family, health. You say, read the book, pick one or two. Write down whatever's most important for you. And then every question has to be answered with yes, no, or number. Seven boxes across, one for every day of the week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Every day, fill it out. At the end of the week, the spreadsheet will give you a report card. Mm-hmm. I warn all of you in advance, a report card at the end of the week might not be quite as beautiful as a corporate values plaque you see stuck up on the wall. I've been doing this for many years. When you do this every day, you know what you quickly learn? You learn that life is incredibly easy to talk.
Yeah.
Life's incredibly difficult to live.
Yeah.
And you do this every day, you don't look at those talk values. Those things are beautiful. You look at those live values, not so pretty. Not so pretty. I don't know about you, but I found I have an incredible, amazing ability. The ability to screw something up every day.
Exactly.
I keep thinking I'm going to slide through a day or two and not screw something up. Not too much. No, pretty much every day. Now, I'm going to share some of my questions, and they're not intended to be yours. One of my questions every day, and this is much more a man question than a woman question. How many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it wasn't worth it?
I do that.
Yeah, almost never got a zero on that one. Kind of hard for that old professor not to be right all the time. Or how many angry or destructive comments did you make about people yesterday? Yeah, we want to treat people with respect. How come we keep stabbing them in the back? How many minutes did you walk? How many push-ups? How many sit-ups? Did you say or do something nice for your wife, your son, your daughter? Just a bunch of questions about life. My friend Jim Moore, you know very well, does this. We'll tell you it saved his life. It didn't kind of save his life. It did save his life. It was one of his questions. Are you currently updated on your physical exam? First 90 days he did this, he said no every day. After 90 days, he said, I got to get the dumb exam or quit asking.
Yeah.
He got the dumb exam. The doctor said, you have cancer. Now, there's years ago. He's going to be fine. The doctor said, had you waited 7 more months, you'd have been dead.
Yeah.
He knew he should have got a physical exam. He was 65 years old. Chief learning officer of 3 multi-billion-dollar companies. He knew he should have done it, but he didn't do it. Everybody look up here. How many women in this room have ever avoided a physical exam before and told yourself, I'm going to get that exam after I go on that healthy food diet and begin and begin my exercise program?
Right.
Now, did we trick the doctor with that strategy?
Yeah.
I was teaching at the University of Michigan. This man raised his hand. I said, sir, did you trick the doctor? He looked at me and goes, I am the doctor. How about the trip to the dentist? Have any of you noticed a flurry of dental flossing activity the 2 days before you walk in? Hey, you're flossing away. You got blood running all out of your mouth. And the dentist says, have you been flossing? Oh, yeah, dentist, I was flossing. Well, this is a great, great exercise.
Right. It is a great exercise.
Now, before we do Q&A, you're going to talk to your partner. And you say, good partner, here's one question I should challenge myself with every day. Your partner's going to say, here's one question I should challenge myself with every day. Go back and forth. And I'll say, stop. Go! Talk to your partner. Talk.
Okay. So that's great. I love this thing. What do you need to challenge yourself with now?
What?
What do you need to challenge yourself with now?
More writing. Yeah. I like people too much. Now, what are we doing next?
Ready?
She's going to ask the question. We're going to open it up to
and
the question.
And then open it up. So I'm going to tell people that if you're in the other room, come here, line up.
Oh, the other room's coming here.
Only one question.
Okay, good.
We don't want to really do a debrief here. Just leave them like that.
If you're ready, you can shut this down. You want to shut
it down? Very good.
Okay. That was
fun.
Yeah. Very
fun. Okay, stop.
So not only was that insightful, but that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly.
So thank you so much. So before we go into Q&A, whoever has questions, feel free to start lining up. And if you're in the other room, feel free to come here and line up for your questions. While you're getting ready with your questions, I'm going to ask mine.
Okay.
So in the book, you talk about how women need to define what it means to rise. Can you give us some examples of the different ways to think about what it means to rise, and why is it so important for us to define what it means for us?
We need to have our own definition of what it would mean to fulfill our highest potential and be able to make the contribution that we want to make in the world. When we talk about women rising, that may involve moving to the highest level position, or it may not. That may not be what motivates you. But what we encourage women to do is really think about, you don't want a frustration of something that you feel you could have contributed or developed, a voice you wanted to have in the world, a change you wanted to make in the world. Rising means really being able to fulfill that at the highest and most inspiring level that you are capable of. Positional power may be an important part of that. It is hard to have influence without position. But there are people who have enormous influence without necessarily having the highest position. So we want to be clear that what we're talking about is not just developing only the next generation of CEOs, although we really want to do that, that it's also, you get to define it for yourself.
Thanks.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Hi, thank you both. When you're talking about, being indispensable because you do good work, I've struggled recently with my manager not really being on board because it's disruptive for them. They don't want to have to find someone new, train someone new, within the company. So how do you rise within the company when, you have that just kind of struggle with your manager of, I want to grow and develop?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to be very clear that you want to grow and develop. If your manager doesn't want to take the time to bring somebody else in, essentially, that's his or her problem. That's part of his or her job. Your job is not taking up the slack for him or her by keeping yourself stuck. Often, I find women are not sufficiently really clear about what they want to achieve, where they want the job that they're in presently to lead. I coached a woman here in Boston. She was at EMC. Now they've merged, but it was a big standalone then. And she had become indispensable to her boss. Right. And he had come up to her one day and he said, I would have recommended you for that position, but you are indispensable. We cannot do without you here. Right. She said, I went away from that feeling really good, like, oh, they love me, I'm doing a great job, et cetera, et cetera. She said, it took me about 3 months to realize, wait a minute, does that mean I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life? Yeah. So the next time that position came available that she really wanted, She marched into his office and she said, I'm very interested in this position. I would slit my wrist to get it, is how she put it. She said, and I need your help, not in slitting a wrist, but in getting the job. And he said, of course, you're great. I'll help you. I'll do whatever it takes. So she really put it to him in a very strong way. And I think that we need to remember it's our job to fulfill our potential. And if the manager doesn't want to take the time, we don't want to aid and abet that at our own expense.
Mm-hmm. One other suggestion is sometimes the right answer is leave. Leave. I always tell people, look, if you're stuck through no fault of your own, start looking for another job. Don't cut off your nose to spite your face. Don't leave with no place to go. Look around. Job offers are good. I tell every one of my clients this, including CEOs, offers are good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can always reject a job offer, but you can never reject a job offer you don't have.
Exactly.
So those job offers are good. You don't have to take it. On the other hand, that gives you freedom. And all of a sudden, if you feel stuck and you feel they're not giving you a chance and you've got another offer, you know what you can say? Goodbye. Yeah. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Sure. Freedom and leverage.
Wait a minute. Good question.
Yeah. Thank you. Let's stick this down.
Good morning. Thank you both for your inspiring and valuable work. I'm a career coach in the Boston area for about 30 years, so thank you. A question I have is I've helped hundreds, maybe 1,000 or so people in my office or over the phone. And the women and men in my office too many times tell me that they do not care to work for women bosses.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you had, I mean, I, yeah. Of course, I coach this. Them around the issue, but I just would really love to hear both of your responses. Why is that? What is happening?
Well, I think, in my experience, there are two things that happen when that occurs. The first is what I said earlier, that people perceive women as not necessarily rising enough and it's not going to benefit. But that's a secondary.
Right.
When I hear people not wanting to work for a woman boss, when I dig down on it, what I find, and this I have to say, of all the behaviors, the 12 behaviors in this book that I think are the most important, the most important one, I think, is habit number 7, which is the need to be perfect. Because perfectionism is rampant among women. It is one of those classic behaviors that can help you get to a certain level because you do great work, you're dedicated, you work really hard, you're precise and correct. And women tend to be, research shows that women tend to be valued and rewarded for being precise and correct. But at a higher level, being precise and correct is not what they're hiring for. That's not what they hire for. Yet women develop this habit of being precise and correct, which feeds a certain perfectionism. And when you get to a senior level, perfectionism is toxic. I've been doing the work I've been doing for 30 years, never once heard anybody say, I work for a perfectionistic boss and I love it. No one says that. So when I see women that other people don't want to work for, when I dig down into it, what I usually find is that woman has an unhealed case of perfectionism.
So that woman boss should be in my office, not the client?
That's correct. That's exactly right. That woman should be in your office and not the client, because perfectionism is a killer at a higher level. And over, when I see instances of women who fail at senior levels, it's perfectionism that gets in their
way. So basically, I'm just acknowledging to the client that could be.
Yeah, okay, exactly.
Thank you.
Very
good. Marshall, sure. I agree. Yeah. By the way, everybody look up here. I want everybody to smile. Smile. I want everybody to take a deep breath. How about all that perfectionist stuff? I'm going to take a deep breath. I want you to go, hand. Yeah, let go of that perfection thing. Yeah, life is too short. Life is too short.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
So how do you break the management bubble? Like, I want to move and manage other people, and I've gotten other different, have had opportunities to get other leadership experience, but actually becoming a manager is hard to be if you don't haven't actually managed people. So how do you get to that point where you have gotten that management experience or getting people to believe in you to give you that opportunity when you haven't had it?
My suggestion is, one is just education. Just get educated in management. Two, what Sally said is get in some kind of program that if there is a high potential leadership program, future program, go to it. And let people know this is your goal. Let them know I want to go into management because that's perfectly okay. And again, if you can't do it in your company, you got to be open-minded to someplace you can. On the other hand, there's absolutely no reason you can't go into management. So you just tell yourself, I am going to do this. Yeah. Not I might do this or I kind of do it. I'm going to do it. And then it's just a matter of how.
Right.
What do you think?
I think, you know, the other thing, the other part of that is that making that commitment, you want to be in management. That's your goal. You've got one mission. You've got one purpose in terms of your job. You want to be in management. The first thing you want to do is start telling people. The first thing you want to do is say to people, my goal is to get into management here. Do you have any thoughts for me? My goal is to get into management here. Who would be helpful for me to know to do that? My goal is to get into management here. Are there any committees or groups doing something in this organization that you think I could join? So get all the ideas that you can from people, and at that same time as you're getting those ideas, some of which will be helpful, some of which will be absolutely useless, but you will still say thank you for that idea. As you gather those ideas, you will also be letting everyone know, hey, here's someone who wants to go into management. They will be on the lookout for opportunities for you. You want to be as verbal and as clear and as upfront about it as you can.
What's your first name?
Akilah.
Akilah. Mm-hmm. Akilah wants to go into management.
Yeah, right.
Is there anyone in this room who might try to help her out? Yay!
Exactly. Right.
Thank you.
Start it now.
Let's go there. Go ahead.
Not over here.
Hi. I have a question for you, Marshall. And I saw that you are so easy to accept your fault, and like you made fun of yourself. That's a good thing, I mean, how you did it. So most women, and I'm talking for myself too, that I'm so fixated at making things look good and nice, and it's hard for me to come out and say, I did all these wrong things, and just laugh at me and then be happy. I don't know, can you share some secrets?
Well, I'm a Buddhist. I'm not a religious Buddhist. I'm a philosophical Buddhist. And I think it's very helpful to me. And I'm not trying to impose this on anyone else, but just speaking for me, you asked me about me. Buddha was brought up rich in a castle. His father was a king. And his whole mission was he'll be happy if he has more. He was able to sneak out of the castle 3 times. You know what he learned? You get old, you get sick, and you die. Shit happens. And, you know, you're rich, you get old, you're sick and die. You're poor, you get old, you're sick and die. And he tried to be happy with less, and that didn't work either. You know, he learned it's only one thing you can ever be happy with, what you have. It's only one time you can ever be happy, now. It's only one place you can ever be happy, here. Yeah. Be happy now.
I want to share also something I learned from Marshall on this, because I am the typical...
Tell the story of us working together. That's a great story.
Yeah, I'm going to tell the Oh Well story, because
that's a really great one.
Marshall and I were working on the book. I was at he's got an apartment in New York. I was there for the day. And we were working hard away, and he got an interruption from his assistant. And he took the call. It's rare to take a call when we're working together. And I heard him, and he said, oh, yeah, Dr. I won't say his name. Maybe I can. Dr. Kim, I was supposed to call him at 2 o'clock. Oh, okay. Oh, well, I'll get back to him. And he hung up. So I'm sitting there. Now, guess what? I know who Dr. Kim is. Dr. Kim is the head of the World Bank. So I'm thinking, okay, if I had gotten a call that I had missed a 2 o'clock call with the head of the World Bank, I would be in hell. I would be giving myself hell. I would feel like I'm never going to get anywhere. Why did I screw up again? What's wrong with me? I went to the wrong college. I'm in the wrong environment. Why did I marry my husband? I mean, I'm just, my whole life would have been leaving me to this moment of total humiliation. So I was astonished by it. And I went home And I couldn't get it out of my mind. And that night I decided, you know, this oh well business is really powerful. Mm-hmm. So I took my printer, I took the biggest font I could get, and I printed a banner in turquoise and put it above my desk, and it said, oh well. Oh well. And in fact, I've thought about having buttons in the color of the book that say, oh well, to pass out to women. So it has been so helpful to me to when something happens, I now go, I kind of channel Marshall. I go, oh well, I screwed up. At least I didn't miss a call with a guy who's the head of the World Bank.
All right, let's go there.
Yeah.
Mike. I actually had pretty much the same question. You know, how can women not, you know, get away from trying to be perfectionists and not, and it's okay to screw up. I get the, oh, well, I like that.
Yeah.
But how can we just kind of say, you know what, it's okay if we screw up and we can't, we don't have to be perfectionists other than the, oh, well, do you have other examples that you could give?
Yeah, I got one. All right, I'll tell you a nice, another Buddhist story, a little Buddha class today. All right, I want everybody to think of one person who makes you feel bad, guilty, angry, and crazy. Can you come up with one? Everybody got one?
Oh, yeah.
Now, if the person is in the room, do not point at the person right now. Now, I got a question. How much sleep is that person losing over you tonight? Yeah.
You got it.
Who's being punished? Who's doing the punishing? You don't have to like that person, respect that person, or agree with that person. Starting now, you're going to tell yourself, you know what? You are no longer going to make me feel bad. Life is too short.
Yeah.
Life is too short. So quit letting other people make you crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let them be crazy on their own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's mine.
Hello. So in a business world, we are constantly making decisions based on the information we have at a certain point of time. Mm. There are times when we come to know something more later, but I'm kind of always scared to point it out, thinking that if I present different views some months later or 2 months later, it might seem, oh, she always changes her mind. Mm-hmm. How to get over that fear and say, hey, now I have different information and now we should do things differently, because now everyone is in the motion of doing things in a certain way.
Mm. I think that the best way to handle that is that when you make a decision to begin with, you want to present it, I believe, this is the best decision for us to make on the information we have available now. New information may surface, in which case we will want to revisit this decision. So that you're already setting the expectation, the recognition that factors could change. And I think this is a really important way to present things, especially in today's environment where change is so rapid, so constant, and the conditions around us can change in very unpredictable ways as a result of being part of a global economy. So I think acknowledging that to begin with is going to be always a help.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Hi. For those of us who are introverts.
Yes.
Who don't have the answers right away, but we're expected to be firefighters in our roles.
Yeah.
What tips, skills, recommendations do you have to be able to come to the table much more quickly than we do?
I'm glad to answer that. I share some of those characteristics. What I think that women are often, there is enormous power in saying, let me reflect on that and get back to you. There's enormous power in that. And we often feel that we have to respond to everything immediately and in real time. And when we do, it's often very ineffective or inefficient. We then have to go back and correct, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Reflection is the best leaders that I know share in common that they're very reflective. So I think establishing that and saying, you know, I can benefit from really taking some time to reflect on this. I will get back to you and then present a time frame. You know, so it's not like just I'll get back to you on that. But it's, you know, it's very specific. Let me reflect on this. Let me get a little more information. And then I'm going to get back to you by the first of next week. Whatever is feasible, you figure that out on case by case. But I think that's a very powerful way to handle it. Yeah. One more.
Last one. Last question.
Oh, sure. We have 10 more minutes, though.
But people are leaving. That's
okay, yeah. Go ahead. The next one.
Okay.
Everybody, just to let you know, the next one's starting 5 minutes late, so we do have more time spend on Q&A. Go ahead.
Okay. So for the folks who have spoken with our management and other leaderships with regards to wanting to go to that next level, take on management, and they're giving you that carrot, that little piece that's going to keep you there in a sense, and they keep going ahead and kicking that stone down the road. How do you work in those types of situations when you do want to rise? You've communicated it. People seem to be on board, but it's just not happening.
I'll go first.
Yeah, sure.
Look for another job. I'm serious. I'm serious. At a certain point in time, I always say never worship the corporate God. The corporate God does not worship you. You know, be willing to leave. You don't want to leave. You want to do the best you can while you're there. On the other hand, if you're doing a great job, you've been given promises, they never seem to be met over and over and over again, at the end of the day, you got to develop some alternatives. Yeah. One of the great women leaders I coach, I'm so proud of her, she didn't get the CEO job, and basically she was putting up with crap, just very bad. And I didn't like it at all. I'm coaching her. I told her, get another job. I won't mention her name, but she gets another job. She goes back to CEO. You know what she says? Uh-huh. Bye-bye. And the CEO said, you can't leave. Well, she said, I've read the law here. There's this anti-slavery clause in America, you see. So CEO said, you can't leave. You know what he said? If you leave, it's going to make me look terrible. A typical man answer. If you leave, it's going to make me look terrible, right? She's one of the only women in top management. She said, well, that breaks my heart, but it sucks to be you. Goodbye. Bye. And then he said, look, here's $5 million.
Yeah.
She said, it's not about the money. He said, 10. Not about the money. He got up to 23. You know what she said? It's about the money.
If you can just wait for a few more minutes, I just want to give these last two speakers, the people who are standing there, a chance. If you could just wait a bit, it's a little distracting for people to be leaving right now. So can you just be respectful to the last two people? Why don't you both make your questions, and they'll do their best to answer their questions.
Hi, I'm Rita Couto. I stood up because I have a question that might be helpful for other women as well. I feel like it's something that happens a lot to us. So in my last performance review, my boss, which is a great boss, the first time I have one in my life, told me, honestly, she said, I really care about your development. You are great technically, but you need to become more assertive.
Yeah.
How do I do that? She said, this is how you're going to grow in this company.
Yeah.
You are too nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've got a wonderful chapter in there called The Disease to Please, which is about people being too nice. And that is expecting, hoping, wanting everyone to think at all times, in all circumstances, that you are a wonderful person. You want that. Most of us want that. But that can really, really hold you back because you're always trying to meet other people's expectations and needs. You can't, and when you get to a more senior leadership role, which is, I'm sure, part of what your boss was talking about, it is really toxic because you have a difficult time holding other people to account. You end up taking up the slack for other people because you can't expose them to the consequences of the mistakes they made, and you have a very difficult time asserting your own boundaries. So I think if you break it down and think about how can I get better at asserting my boundaries and identifying what they are, what I to say yes to, what to say no to, how can I bring some intentionality to that, and how can I develop a way of holding other people to account that's not, brusque or a style that I'm not comfortable with, but nevertheless be able to do that, then you will really be more assertive in terms of your own leadership style.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
The last one question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you spoke about making sure that they know what you're contributing and saying, you know, this is what I've done and so on. So how does it happen? Many times you sit in a meeting, you say something, it gets ignored, your coworker is saying the same thing, it's like, oh my God, that's a great idea, you know?
Yeah.
And then later, you can't take credit for that, because then it looks like, oh, you're trying to get it from this other guy, because he said so.
I can tell you what to do.
How do you do that without...
You do it two ways. You do it in the moment by saying, when that other person says that, thank you for agreeing with me. It's a very nice way of doing it. It's kind of humorous. It's light touch. It's not like, well, I said that first. No, thank you for agreeing with me. If it happens consistently, you get somebody beforehand and said, look, I'm going into this room. This has happened to me 50 times where somebody has echoed my idea. Would you watch? And if that happens, and if you're comfortable, you know, mention that I also made that point and be my champion here. Those are the two most effective ways of handling it. So thank you.
So thank you so much for waiting, and thank you very much for this.